KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
They can dictate their own creativity in the medium and, maybe catch a little wave, get a little traction, put themselves out there in a different way.
Now we have an attorney from the city attorney's office who can be assigned to this issue, who we know can respect the confidences of the department and the city.
So what did you think about it after you heard about it?
Nothing. Just another person got shot.
That's a clip from This American Life, a student talking to a counselor about violence. He's seen Mayor McGinn talking about City Attorney Pete Holmes and comedian and podcaster Mark Maron about why comics do like podcasting. Some of the many topics we're going to be touching on this hour on weekday from 94.9 KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman. Steve Scherer is off. President Obama is speaking this morning from the White House. The automatic spending cuts known as the sequester will take effect tonight at 11:59 p.m. unless there is some last-ditch agreement. Congress so far has been unable to reach a deal that would prevent the sequester. And here is something from the president's speech this morning.
None of this is necessary. It's happening because a choice that Republicans in Congress have made. They've allowed these cuts to happen because they refuse to budge on closing a single wasteful loophole to help reduce the deficit.
We're going to talk more about the sequester in our 10 o'clock hour when our news roundtable panel comes in. From national, we move to very local. Earlier this week, Seattle police officers shot and killed a Greenwood man with a history of mental illness. According to police, they were responding to a 911 call. The man was threatening to shoot his father. Meanwhile, oversight of Seattle's police department has sparked infighting at City Hall. Earlier in the week, Mayor McGinn and City Attorney Pete Holmes faced off over Holmes' involvement with police reform negotiations. Those negotiations stem from a city agreement with the U.S. Department of Justice aimed at stemming alleged excessive use of force and biased policing. Seattle Times staff reporter Steve Miletich covers this and many other issues. He's been following the recent developments at City Hall, and Steve's with us in the studio. Thanks for coming in.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Let's walk back a couple steps before we talk about this week's thing and refresh our memories as to the people involved in this reform negotiation.
Well, this dates to December of 2011 when the Department of Justice issued a report finding that the Seattle Police Department had engaged in excessive force and also that there was evidence of biased policing. And from that, there were negotiations between the Department of Justice and the city over how to resolve this. It would either go forward with a lawsuit or a settlement. They did reach a settlement in July to deal with these issues and related matters. As a result of that, one of the tasks assigned to an independent monitor who was appointed to oversee the agreement was to come up with a roadmap for how to carry out these reforms. And that person is Merrick Bobb. And he is now working with the city, Mayor McGinn, and City Attorney Pete Holmes has been involved to try to do that.
So Merrick Bobb was appointed by the federal judge. He's in Los Angeles normally?
He's the head of a police assessment center, a nonprofit in Los Angeles, and he has a team of people working with him.
Now, as I understand from your article published in the paper this morning, this week's flare-up at City Hall stems from an email exchange between Merrick Bobb and Police Chief John Diaz.
Well, not exactly an email exchange, but Merrick Bobb has presented a proposed monitoring plan, that roadmap I just referred
to. And that's his job to do that.
That's
right?
His job to do that. Chief Diaz, on Monday, in a letter to Mr. Bobb, responded, expressing some concerns with that proposed monitoring plan, saying that there were some elements of it that didn't provide proper guidance, and moreover, that some of Mr. Bobb's plan went beyond the scope of what was in the settlement agreement reached in July. So you have a difference of opinion between the two men.
And how is Pete Holmes involved in that exchange?
Well, Mr. Holmes was dismayed when he found out about Chief Diaz's letter because he felt that it had the possibility of harming the process. And so Mr. Holmes wrote his own letter on Tuesday saying that perhaps there was a more collaborative approach that could be considered in all this. He said if Mr. Bob was inclined to agree with the SPD, that was fine. He would go along with it. But if Mr. Bob did not agree, he had some alternative suggestions, and he presented an alternative plan. And that, in turn, made the mayor quite angry, who he accused Mr. Holmes of interfering and acting unethically, and said that he was no longer going to allow Mr. Holmes to represent the city in this matter.
To which Mr. Holmes replied,
I'm not stepping aside. It's my job to, city attorney for the city, to be its chief litigator.
Well, does he have a point, Pete Holmes?
Well, that's going to be sorted out. I don't think we've ever quite been down this path before. It's Seattle's equivalent of a constitutional crisis. I guess it's a charter crisis based on the city charter. There's a split here of opinion. Mr. Holmes says, my overall job is to represent the best interests of the city, not just the mayor and the police department. And I don't think that what the mayor and the police chief are doing is in the best interest of the city. The mayor, I believe, is taking the position that he's the chief executive who sets policy, and that Mr. Holmes is supposed to be his attorney, and that if he can't trust his attorney, he needs to have somebody else in that office represent him.
Well, and the city attorney is not appointed by the mayor, for people who need to remember that. It's an elected position, the same as the mayor.
And there's the rub. You have two elected officials, both exerting executive power, it may have to be sorted out by a judge, the judge in this case, or perhaps if some kind of a legal action was filed in King County Superior Court to resolve this. It's too early to know, but I think both sides are looking at their options.
But Steve Miletich, this is fascinating politics, but as a citizen of Seattle, how does it, realistically, how does it impact me?
Well, I think it impacts everybody because it has the potential of derailing or slowing the reform process that I think is at the heart of all this, and that everyone agrees is the most important thing. But when you have this kind of bitter dispute going on, it distracts from the underlying issue.
So we've, just to clarify also in my mind, this is all ordered by the Justice Department, part of the settlement that the city reached with the Justice Department. There's also the so-called 2020 police reform plan or police monitoring plan. And how do those dovetail, if at all?
Well, there's some overlap between the two, although they are two separate things, but they're both aimed at police reform. The 2020 plan was devised by the mayor and the police department prior to that settlement agreement being reached. It was kind of a get-ahead-of-it type action on his part to deal with reform, but it did not stop the settlement process from going forward, and there are more formal agreements in that.
So they're parallel efforts at reform. Are they both proceeding? Well, actually, it sounds like neither of them is proceeding now.
No, the 2020 plan is proceeding, and it's reached about a halfway point. And the mayor recently spelled out some of the goals that have been achieved. And the settlement process is moving forward, although this current battle stems from a key step in the whole process, how to come up with that roadmap. I mean, that's a very important milestone in this process, and it has to be reached. And to have this all kind of blow apart raises some questions about how they're going to do that.
And so if we're at this impasse, who gets to look down at the city and say, you're the one? Does it have to be decided from the parties involved? Or?
Well, I think the parties will probably make some attempt to resolve this, although the tenor of the conversation isn't very pleasant right now.
Not at all.
Should they not be able to reach agreement, or Mr. Holmes and Mr. McGinn, there is a court hearing on March 12th in front of Judge Robart for a status review of the case. I would expect that this would come before Judge Robart, who has been very active in overseeing this case, and he may have to sort it all out.
Well, we'll read about it in the Seattle Times, I assume. Thank you so much for coming in. Steve Miletich is a Seattle Times staff reporter covering justice issues and the rift at Seattle City Hall over the independent monitoring roadmap plan. This is Weekday.
It's 9:15. A psychoanalytic approach to curbing youth violence in a minute on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Keeping up with events happening here at home and around the world is challenging, but public radio makes it easier. And it's your financial support of KUOW that makes it all possible. You may have recently received an appeal in the mail. Please mail in your gift today or give online at KUOW.org. Your support right now will help keep our upcoming spring membership drive on target so we can get you back to regular programming sooner. Thank you for your generosity. It's cloudy and rainy and 52 degrees in Seattle. Clouds and rain probably going to stick around. We might get up to 59 this afternoon, and then we're expecting clouds overnight with a low of 45. Comedian, actor, podcaster Mark Maron in 20 minutes.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. Steve Scher is off. Youth violence has dominated the news lately, from the spiking homicide rate in Chicago to tragic mass shootings in Aurora, Colorado, and Newtown, Connecticut. Many people see tougher gun laws as the key solution to quelling youth violence, but others, like Dr. Mark Smaller, are tackling the issue on a much more personal level. For the past 7 years, Dr. Smaller has led Project Realize, an in-school treatment and research program at Morton Alternative High School in Cicero, Illinois. It's just outside of Chicago. Dr. Smaller's president-elect of the American Psychoanalytic Association, and he joins me in the studio. Thanks for coming in here.
Pleasure.
We just discovered before the microphone went on that we're both from Michigan, and you stayed a little bit closer to the home. I'm curious, before we talk specifically about Project Realize and the Morton Alternative Program, what set you out on the path to work with youth?
Well, I had been a psychoanalyst for a number of years, and I was approached by a colleague who was a therapist and working, a social worker, and working part-time at an alternative high school, Morton Alternative, at the outskirts of Chicago. And he invited me to come out and visit, where he was seeing some kids, mostly in groups, but occasionally individually. So I went out to the school. I rescheduled patients early on a Wednesday morning. This was almost 10 years ago, and met with the teachers, met with the principal, with the kids, sat in on the groups. And as I've said and written about, it probably took me about 7 to 10 minutes to fall in love with the kids. Most of these kids have been expelled for violent behavior, gang-related behavior in the local high schools in the area. And so I spent a couple hours at the school, got ready to leave, and the principal said, "Thank you," and I said, "No, thank you." Mm-hmm. And I was literally about to go through the security vehicle, and I turned around and said, "Maybe I'll come back just one more time. That there's an issue that came up in that group. I want to see how it's going to get resolved." And so the next week, I rescheduled patients again, much to their dismay, early Wednesday morning, went back out to the school and did the same thing, sat in on the group, met with teachers, a couple parents as well, and got ready to leave. Same thing. I said, "Well, maybe just one more time." And I've literally been going ever since.
Had you been working with youth of any kind really before that?
Well, I had done some consulting at some private high schools in Chicago. And I'm an adult and child adolescent psychoanalyst, okay. So I'd seen people in my office. And I had also developed a peculiar skill of being able to raise money for psychoanalytic organizations. So when the social worker said to me, after I started to go out to the school regularly, it would be great if we could see some of these kids individually and not just in groups. And because even the group treatment helps, and if we could raise some money, maybe bring in some other social workers. And that's what we did. And we now see there are 50 kids in the school, and we see probably close to 15 kids individually. All 50 kids are seen in groups. We use a very psychoanalytically oriented kind of treatment. We call it the forward edge approach, and we really focus on what we call sort of normal adolescent interests, impulses, and aspirations to move forward in their lives. And all these kids have that.
I have a couple of questions about Cicero in general. There are two high schools, as I understand, two general high schools. So these Is this a working class community, an extremely poor community?
Cicero is it's a working class community. Back in the 60s, it's a community where Martin Luther King marched, actually. It became, over the last 35, 40 years, mostly a Hispanic community. There are probably 10 different gangs in the area. And the kids are faced with, you know, sometimes unspeakable challenges in terms of trauma that they've experienced at home, trauma they experience out on the streets with regards to violence, whether they've been victims of it or participants of it. But once they come into the school, and once we are able to see them, you know, in a safe, predictable, reliable context like school, they are able to do, almost in my mind, miraculous things in terms of moving forward, getting back involved in school, concentrating on their work, as long as we address the sort of trauma that many of them have experienced.
I know that the kids that make their way to Morton Alternative have been expelled usually for some reason. Are those always violence-related reasons?
They may be violence-related. They may have shown up to school with drugs in their backpack. But one of the jokes that we have is when we start a group, you know, each fall, the one that I participate in, we'll ask the kids, we'll say, so what brought you here? And 9 times out of 10, they'll say the same thing. They'll say, wrong place, wrong time. And they'll describe, for example, that they came to school with a knife in their backpack. And so what I will often say to them is, well, but wait a minute, you knew you'd have to go through a security check at the high school, and yet, you know, you forgot, you know, a knife in the backpack. And I say, you know, it must be your way. Maybe you weren't aware of it, but you figured out a way to come over to the alternative school and get some extra help. To which they respond, that's a lot of BS, Dr. Smaller, and I don't want to be here. By the middle, or certainly by the end of that first year, they really start to flourish at the school. And they want to be there because they, like all of our kids, like all teenagers in high school, they do want to excel and move forward, even though they have these difficulties at times based on what they've experienced growing up to do so.
We're talking with Dr. Mark Smaller about Project Realize, which is a program at the Morton Alternative School, which is in Cicero, Illinois, just outside of Chicago. And Dr. Smaller's been, I think now you are attached to the school. You don't just come in as an ad hoc counselor anymore.
Well, Project Realize is its own nonprofit entity, and it's supported by foundations, individual donors. I've also replicated an aspect of the program in Southwest Michigan, where I live, in Saugatuck. And I was just remarking to some friends and colleagues the last couple of days, analyst colleagues, that a lot of the issues, even in a white middle-class high school like in Saugatuck, Michigan, a lot of those same issues are the same issues that come up in Cicero.
What kinds of issues specifically?
Normal adolescent angst, issues having to do with relationships with peers, relationships with guys, girls, anxiety about graduating, about what's in store beyond graduation. That's particularly challenging for our kids because most of them will be the first ones to graduate from high school, much less go to college. We've expanded our project so that we not only get them emotionally back on track in terms of our individual and group work with them, we work with parents, but we've just added a college prep program. We have an expert who's a clinical social worker who has a particular expertise in first generation kids going to college. We had an experience a couple months ago. We had taken the kids to one of the colleges, and she had visited a dorm. And on the way back, she said to the staff, she could never go to college or live in that dorm because it was too nice of a place for her, and she couldn't imagine herself there. And we helped them begin to address some of those things and what it's going to mean to leave the neighborhood.
We're talking about working with troubled youth, and that's a generic and kind of sappy term. But what I'm wondering, first of all, about the program at Morton is whether is this an alternative to incarceration? Would these kids, or are these kids not yet at that point?
This is really the last stop. And many of our kids, if they do get expelled from the system, it's very likely that they could end up incarcerated, if not much worse, if not being killed on the street. We at any time will have 9 or 10 different gangs represented in the school. But like I said, once in the school, in the safe, predictable, reliable place of the school, the gang stuff is left outside. And although we joke, I'll joke with the kids. I'll say, okay, so if I saw you on Cermak Street, you know, I assume even if you were with your guys, you'd say hello to me because we've become such good friends. And they'll say, no way, I can't even acknowledge your existence out on the street. But in the school, they get a sense of what it means to be genuinely connected to an adult who's really interested in their moving forward, and they respond to it.
You know, it strikes me that one of the things, besides having all these trained adults and therapists and psychiatrists in the school, is that it's a small place. And, you know, we're talking about urban high schools with lots of problems, and there's 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 kids.
It's, you know, this is the greatest challenge. And we've spent much more time in the last couple of years working with our teachers. The challenge of teaching kids who come from backgrounds where they've experienced sometimes unspeakable trauma, it is incredibly challenging, but we work very closely with teachers in terms of how to respond to kids individually, and that actually can be replicated even in a high school of 2,000 or 3,000 kids. But it needs to be done. The administration needs to be able to support it. One of the reasons we've been successful is that our principal, from the first time I walked into the school, just got it. He himself, Rudy Hernandez, grew up in a similar neighborhood. He knows that we must think about these kids in a very three-dimensional way. We're not just interested in their academic growth, but their emotional growth is essential.
I want to play a couple of clips. I don't know if you heard this, but This American Life just ran a two-part series about violence at Chicago's Harper High School. And this is some tape of a junior at Harper named Thomas, who's seen several of his friends who were young people get shot. And it's part of Alex Kotlowitz's series. Thomas, in these clips, is meeting with his social worker, and she's trying to get him to explain how it feels to have all that emotion bottled up inside.
You know Nugget, little brother, got shot Monday.
No. Is he okay?
Got shot in his stomach and his leg.
Little brother? How old is her little brother?
Like 15.
And what school does he go to?
I don't know.
So what did you think about it after when you heard about it, after you heard about it?
Nothing.
Nothing?
Just another person got shot.
Just another person got shot.
And you hear that sigh, just another person got shot.
One of the most painful things that working at Morton Alternative, where we've experienced a lot of these same things, where there have been shootings in the neighborhood or we'll lose a student, this capacity for developing what I call just numbness. And the students develop it. It's like it's a post-traumatic stress reaction, and they just go numb inside because that's really the only way to survive. However, what I want to underscore is that and I listened to much of that series, is when we get into the groups, and this is what the kids have taught us, they want and need an opportunity to talk about some of this trauma or things they've witnessed or have been a part of or the victim of. And yet that ultimately is not our focus. And they have taught us that what they really want and need from us, from teachers, from therapists, from the principal, and from their parents, they really want us to focus on their, what I call their normal aspirations and ambitions to move forward, to deal with relationship issues, to deal with issues in terms of them and their friends, to deal with their issues that come up with teachers or their parents. Anything no different than my kids, no different than anybody's kids. And one of the things that I am always struck by when I bring visitors out to the school, prospective donors or colleagues who are interested in what we're doing or other social workers who want to replicate parts of the project, they leave the school, and 9 times out of 10, they say the exact same thing. They say, these are just normal kids. And in the context of the school, of the safety of the school, they are just normal kids.
We're talking with Dr. Mark Smaller. He's president-elect of the American Psychoanalytic Association, and he has led Project Realize for the past 7 years. You mentioned a bit ago that one of the students, you were joking with him about whether he'd recognize you on the streets. And I'm, you know, got me to wondering, here are these kids that find their way to this alternative small program with lots of help. But how long does it take to break down? There must be those walls that we were just talking about. And I'm wondering if you could give some specific examples of kids and the adjustment period.
I'll be giving a detailed example tonight at the Stuart Pat lecture that's brought me to Seattle. We will have kids who will keep their distance, their understandable distance, in group and in individual treatment. And yet, once they feel like this is a reliable, predictable relationship with the therapist or the group therapist, they will begin to talk about things like we had last year, 2 years ago, one of our students disappeared for a couple weeks. One of my favorites in the group, I'll call him Michael. And when he came back, I tried to talk with him about it. He got very angry with me. He said, "I don't want to talk about it." And he told me that in no uncertain terms and no uncertain language. The next week, he came back to the group. And he, you know, Michael was not in a gang, but he worked in between gangs. He sold drugs to, you know, to all the different gangs, and at the same time worked at a hardware store. But he came back a week later, and he apologized. And I said, you know, I appreciate that. It's not necessary, but I appreciate that. I was just concerned when we didn't see you for a couple weeks. And what had happened, he had gotten into there was a fair amount of volatility at home. His parents, his father had been involved in gangs. And they had ended up having a fist fight. So he was just staying with friends. And what had precipitated his anger with me was that same in that group, was that we had been talking about encouraging the kids, encouraging their parents to come for what we call parents' night, where we supply parents with dinner. And that just hit the sore spot for him. But the fact that he came back and talked with me about it and then resumed his work at school, he graduated 2 years ago. The last we heard, he's still working in the hardware store, and his business on the street has lessened as his more important business at the hardware store has increased.
How many of these kids go back to a traditional high school once they get to alternative school?
Well, you know, one of the jokes that we have at school, our clinical director, Dave Miles, and I, when the kids come, we'll tell them in the group, even if they want to leave, we'll block the door. And they, we say that with a smile. Some of them do go back. Some of them, and by the time they go back, they really have made some gains and solidified some gangs, and they're on a track that they can maintain and sustain things back at the regular high school. The high school, I think it has about 3,000 kids. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Some of our kids will graduate right from the alternative school. We have a wonderful graduation. We get parents involved, and not surprisingly, the more we've gotten parents involved over the last 10 years, the better the kids have done. We get them to one parent dinner. We usually have three of them a year. If we can get the parents to come to one parent dinner, their kids start doing better in school. It's like magic.
And this program, you think, is replicable?
Absolutely. And in fact, we brought out somebody who is going to help us raise some money on the North Shore of Chicago. The parent of our associate director, Kate Romy, we brought her mother out to the school for one of our parents' nights, and I give a talk about parenting the impossible profession, like psychoanalysis, or God forbid, being married to a psychoanalyst. And I give this talk about the difficulties of parenting, and she said that talk needs to be given at Nutrier High School on the North Shore of Chicago. So yeah, there are aspects of this that could be replicated in any school.
Dr. Mart Smaller talking about Project Realize in Morton Alternative School. He's going to speak tonight at 7:30 at Seattle's Town Hall. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman.
It's 9:34, a conversation with comedian, actor, and podcaster Mark Maron in a minute. KUOW 94.9 Seattle. In traffic news, there's an accident on I-5 southbound at Roanoke. Lanes are blocked and traffic is backed up. Also on 520 westbound to southbound I-5, there's a collision blocking the ramp.
Say you have a baby.
Did you see the owl?
Yeah, my tail.
You raise her with love.
One day I'm going to be able to tell her, you can do this. Push yourself.
The kid's going to turn out exactly as you planned, right?
Yeah.
Hold on here. It would be nice if life was like that, but life isn't like that. Life is hard.
Are we bound by our DNA? Or can a parent change it? That's on the next Radio Lab.
Tonight at 7 o'clock.
Support for KUOW comes from North Seattle Community College, committed to improving lives through education, with short-term certificates, associate and transfer degrees, and career training, including international business, engineering, and more. Enrolling now for spring quarter. Information at northseattle.edu.
52 degrees, cloudy, and generally rainy in Seattle. 9:35, we'll get a detailed weekend weather forecast from Washington State climatologist Nick Bond in 20 minutes.
This is Weekday. I'm Katie Sewell. Mark Maron is a writer, performer, and 25-year veteran of the stand-up comedy stage. He's been a talk radio host on the Air America Network and made 46 appearances on Late Night with Conan O'Brien, which is more than anyone else. These days, he's the host of a very successful podcast called WTF with Mark Maron. He just posted his 365th episode, and he's performing tonight in Seattle at the Neptune Theater. Mark Maron, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure to be here.
So if this were your podcast, where would you begin an interview?
I usually turn the mics on before we start talking on the mics and play around with whatever's on my desk and bring up something about my own life. And then see what happens.
What would you say your style as an interviewer is?
I don't really know. I don't really look at them as interviews. I look at them as just conversations. I do very little research, and I'll just get a sense of somebody, and I want to make sure not to miss out on anything important that they might have done, if I should know about that. But I don't generally find myself ever writing down questions. I just make these little notes during the interview of things that I should follow up with or things that I should remember, and that's sort of it. I don't see them as interviews, really.
Well, you primarily interview comedians, right?
No, I interview a lot of people. I interview musicians, I interview actors, I interview comedians, some writers. Like, I just had Mike White on the other day. I had Mel Brooks and Carl Reiner on last week, and I've had, Lucinda Williams, Jack White. So I try to mix it up a little bit. But, I started with comedians, but, there's only so many comedians. But there's a lot more than you would think.
Yeah, and a lot of them have podcasts.
That's what I understand. I think I'm probably responsible for some of that.
I was going to ask you why you think comedians are drawn to podcasting.
Well, why wouldn't they be? They can say whatever they want. It doesn't really cost them any money yet, not much, to get the equipment. They can dictate their own creativity in the medium, and maybe catch a little wave, get a little traction, put themselves out there in a different way to a new audience or to an audience that they're trying to connect with.
Is that why you started?
No, I started out of desperation. I'd done some radio, and I enjoyed the format. And I was broke and in the middle of a divorce, and my career was sort of stalled. And I knew that some comics were doing that, so I thought, well, maybe I should give it a try. And that was the birth of that.
So, how would you say you're doing a stand-up show here in Seattle? How would you say that being a podcaster has changed how you are on stage? Or has it?
Well, it's changed everything. When I've actually been able to work through bits on the podcast, because I generally improvise my monologue without the burden or the context of having people around me, and it's just a free form thinking. I've come upon a lot of stuff that I've investigated later on stage, and also I've got people that know me very well now that come to see me, and they know exactly what they're getting into, and it's not some sort of generalized comedy experience, and that provides me with a lot more freedom on stage and a lot more connection to my audience.
Now, one of the things we've been hearing about is these patent trolls who are going after podcasters, and I know you've been writing a little bit about that. Can you explain what's going on there?
Yeah, these patent trolls are businesses built on owning patents and not building anything with them, and sometimes they register these patents that are very broad, and they find a friendly patent office, usually in Texas, and then once they own the patents, they sue, they coerce and try to extort money from people with, you know, with the patent system and the legal American legal system behind them. So usually, from what I understand, these are usually cases that have to do with software, and it's very it's prevalent in the tech industries. But now, you know, they're going after content providers, and a few podcasters are being sued, and some of us are being contacted to license podcasting. There's a patent troll out there, Personal Audio, who claims to own the patent for podcasting. It's a very broad patent, which is not unusual for patent trolls. And now there's three lawsuits against a few different entities, How Stuff Works, with the Discovery Network, and Adam Carolla has had a lawsuit filed against him. And the way that patent trolls make money is that they know that they usually go after smaller businesses, but usually tech businesses, and they know that these businesses cannot afford to litigate because it's ridiculously expensive and would kill anybody, millions of dollars generally, just to litigate this stuff. So they're just hoping people will roll over and just give them the money they want so they can continue doing what they want to do without being bankrupted. It's a very horrible phenomenon, and we're trying to figure out what to do as a community, and some political action is now happening in Congress with the SHIELD Act, and I would really tell people to go to the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which is EFF, and they have a website where you can learn a little bit more about this, and also sign a petition to push this legislation through that would enable what the legislation would do is they would make it a law that, you know, if a patent troll sued on a patent that turned out to be not solid, they would be responsible for who they were suing's legal fees. And that would hopefully be a deterrent. So that's where this is at. Unfortunately, the same patent laws that enable this to happen also enable larger companies to patent software and enable them to win lawsuits, you know, like Apple did over Samsung. So, yeah, it cuts both ways. You know, I don't know that there's a big movement towards changing the patent system because of that, and that's where the big money is. But certainly when it comes down to us, to just, you know, dudes doing a podcast in their garage, all of a sudden we have to pay because someone claims to own podcasting. It's a little troubling, and it's a little scary.
It seems like it could really alter the future of podcasting going forward if something doesn't happen to stop it.
Well, I mean, somebody's got to challenge the patent and decide, with this software patenting business, and especially when this is the business, you know, nobody is sympathetic to these guys. I mean, this is just a weird sort of, not quite a loophole, but it's really a legal extortion racket. How it will change things, I don't know. Hopefully we can pull together and fight it, and we'll see if that happens, or else, you know, podcasters are, you know, going to end up paying licensing fees to someone who owns a patent.
Do you feel slightly more immune personally because you're not only podcasting, but your podcast is being distributed by the Public Radio Exchange in a slightly cleaned up format? Does that give you another option, another avenue?
I don't know. Yeah, nobody's immune. You know, it's very easy for people, you know, to listen to this or to think about it. Uh-oh, I'm in the children's lounge, and I think a child wants to come in. Hold on. I just tucked away in here, so, but I'd like to let the kid play. So, I don't know if anyone's immune. You know, nobody wants this kind of shit to fall on them. Oh, sorry, you're going to have to bleep that, but... But, the truth of the matter is like, you can look at this thing and you can say, well, this is ridiculous. This is stupid. This can't hold up. Well, the truth of the matter is, the only way to prove that is to litigate. And in order to litigate, you know, especially from, you know, our point of view, it's like, how are we going to afford that? So, you know, what choice do we really have? So, yeah, no one's immune from these kind of things. You just hope that this kind of, you know, ridiculous, dubious, you know, evil type of business practice doesn't land on your doorstep. So there's no immunity. It's just, you know, the legal system makes it very difficult for the little guy to take action in almost any way. And that's how people get crushed. And that's a sad thing. But, yeah, I mean, I could do radio again, I guess. But why?
We're speaking with Mark Maron, a stand-up comedian, host of the podcast WTF with Mark Maron. And we're speaking to him at the airport where he's currently in the children's lounge.
No, I had to leave because the kid wanted to go in
there. See, you couldn't play
with him.
No,
I'm just annoying people with my loud radio voice to talk to you out in the regular world. I'm in the Admiral's Club
in
Dallas,
very nice.
Fort Worth. It's all right, you know.
He's performing here at the Neptune at 7 p.m. Okay, well, let's switch gears just slightly since we just have a few minutes left because we wanted to ask you about the Oscars, which were last Sunday. Our producer, Jason, was following your tweeting during the Academy Awards, and he was wondering, since you were commenting so much, what you did when you watched the Academy Awards before Twitter existed.
Well, you know, you just check in occasionally, and you kind of, you know, wait. You probably turn it on at the end. I on and off over the years, I don't remember how important the Oscars were, thinking back on it. It was this thing that happened, but now it's become a big business, and everybody seems to be very locked into it. But my recollection is all you really cared about was those last four or five awards, and you know, most of the time you wouldn't even bother watching the show because you could just find out what happened. But now, yeah, I mean, with Twitter, it makes it sort of fun, and, you know, being a little more aware and involved in show business, it becomes sort of exciting. And I've always been one to love movie stars as a child and growing up, and I like seeing movie stars sitting there. So, you know, I don't know. I probably just sat there and wondered, you know, how fun would it be to hang out with Jack Nicholson?
Yeah,
that's probably what I used to do. Now I don't know if that fantasy really holds up. He's not what he used to be, old Jack. You know, everybody gets older.
Do you agree with the winners, like Argo as Best Picture, for instance?
Well, out of the ones I've seen, I mean, I can't, you know, it sort of makes sense that it won. It was certainly a Hollywood movie about Hollywood sort of saving the world in a way. So, you know, it makes sense. I mean, you know, the Oscars obviously are not without politics in terms of, you know, show business politics. But I thought it was a fine movie. I was a big fan of Silver Linings Playbook. I thought that was a tremendously, you know, intimate, almost claustrophobic, you know, romantic comedy that was much more raw than I'd ever seen. And I certainly related to that. And I thought Lincoln was pretty great because it was really about politics. But, yeah, I just don't – after a certain point, you know, the backlighting in Spielberg movies makes you wonder, like, what he's trying to do exactly. I mean, they could not have had spotlights around the Capitol building at that time. So it's a little ridiculous, but it was certainly something to watch.
Well, I should have you comment on Seth MacFarlane's hosting, since he's been so criticized in the media this week for everything from sexism to just making tons of jokes people found completely inappropriate. What was your take?
They should just shut up. Quit being babies. You know, it's ridiculous. I mean, you know, once you get involved with something that really matters, if you're going to, you know, get worked up about something. I mean, I thought that, you know, his only faults were really that it's not really his forte. He doesn't have as much stage experience as other people that have hosted before. But I thought his jokes were great, and I thought he lacked a little confidence around some of them. Hmm. And I thought that the way that they integrated what usually becomes tedious in recent Oscars, which is, you know, song and dance and a sort of respect for, you know, that part of Hollywood's history, I thought he did very well. I thought it was a nice idea to integrate actors and actresses in song and dance routines, and I thought that the schmaltz factor was very low. I think that his opening bit was a little long. I didn't immediately, when I heard the boob thing, I thought it was, you know, it was kind of, it was a gutsy thing to do, but it didn't you know, I'm not a woman, but it read more cute than sexist to me. And yeah, sure, his jokes were inappropriate, but so what? They're jokes. People should shut up.
Would you accept an offer to host the Academy Awards?
I'd be so nervous. I would be so nervous. I probably would, because, you know, no matter how scared I am of something, that's usually when I go do it, you know, see what happens. That's how I learn. Yeah, of course I would accept it.
It would give you that chance to hang out with Jack Nicholson, at least. Possibly.
Yeah, you know, I don't know, I'd like to interview Jack Nicholson or talk to him. Yeah, I just, you know, there's just part of me that even as I get to know these people as people, you know, I talked to some, you know, fairly big movie stars, and, you know, I came up with some guys that, you know, are pretty big stars now. I enjoy the spectacle of it. I like Hollywood in that way. I always did. You know, it's very, the movies are very powerful, and they've had a lot of impact on my life, and I like seeing the people in movies.
Marc Maron is a stand-up comedian, host of the WTF podcast, and he's also the creator of an upcoming television show that's based on his life called Maron, which is premiering this spring. And if you want to see him live, you can tonight. He's performing at the Neptune Theater in Seattle's University District at 7 p.m. Hey, thanks, Marc, for taking the time to talk to us.
Oh, good to talk to you. Take care.
This is Weekday.
And now,
this is the sound of the week. The sound of the week.
That will be in line with what, at polls show, a majority of Americans want to see done.
That was Eli Sanders in there. He's coming up in the next hour. Those were the sounds of this week on Weekday. Listener Shauna had been hearing that circus music over and over again. Her kids just love it, as you heard. Sound could have been them laughing. Paul sent us the sound of a pot of water warming on his wood stove, and it sounded a lot more like a drum solo than sizzling water does. Sounds of birds chirping came from Jeremy, who recorded them when he was in Nicaragua, where he's been living. And the last sound, also the sound of Riches Week. He cranked up an old Free Play wind-up radio from 1998 one day when his power went out, so he can continue listening to our panel of journalists. As always, we turn to you. What interesting sounds have you been listening to? Record 30 seconds and send that sound to us along with the story behind the recording. You can email it to weekday@kuow.org. Please include sound of the day in your subject line, and we love them. We love to get those sounds. And we also love to hear about what is happening in our atmosphere. And for that, we turn to state climatologist Nick Bond, who is with us once again with the weekend weather forecast. Hey, Nick.
Good morning.
How are you?
Pretty well, thanks.
When I was outside earlier, it was kind of spitty, gray, and warm.
Yeah, it's not quite Florida, but still really balmy for this part of the country at this time of year. A low temperature at SeaTac Airport was 52 last night,
My.
Which is at least 10 degrees above normal. But so we're going to have a warm day today, and cloudy, and dribs and drabs of rain, especially in the mountains. And it could even get to 60 degrees, which it kind of depends. You know, some spots may be a little warmer. It's probably more likely high 50s, but still pretty warm for this time of year.
And is that going to hang around?
Well, Saturday will start off okay, but it looks like we're in south of a warm front, and a cold front is poised off the coast and is going to sweep through here late afternoon tomorrow, and bringing some rain with it, and much cooler air. The freezing levels in the mountains are going to go from something like 7,000 feet to 1,500 feet.
Oh, my gosh.
And so that'll be a noticeable change. But tomorrow should start off okay, and then showers around on Sunday. And Sunday night looks to be kind of a chilly evening, but not, you know, too much drama.
I don't know if you know these sorts of things, but it seems like we're out of the snow danger time of year. Am I right?
Kind of yes and no. It's less likely, but we have gotten a half a foot of snow on March 1st, you know, this day of the year. And so it turns out that snowfall is still possible here, you know, through the first few weeks of March. The frequency of it goes down. But, you know, while we're not out of the woods, the clock is ticking. And so, you know, winter is ending.
So we're just for the very short term present, we can expect a warm day with that, not heavy rain, but on and off showers, and in raining in the mountains today as well.
Yeah, a little bit of rain in the mountains. So probably not a great ski day today. And just, but again, just kind of dribs and drabs today and just kind of gray and
gray.
Sort of humid.
It is humid out. It almost feels, as you mentioned, Floridian, but not quite. You are going to be giving a workshop today about water temperature, I think.
Well, it's a part of, I'm giving a talk at the Pacific Northwest Weather Workshop, and what I'm going to talk about is something called J-Scope. Now, that sounds like an uncomfortable medical procedure, but it actually stands for JASAO's Seasonal Coastal Ocean Prediction Experiment.
Uh-huh.
And so we're interested in trying to take advantage of these climate model forecasts that are being run for seasonal weather prediction and see if we can make them, use them to make projections for our coastal waters.
And how would you do that?
Well, we embed an ocean model that's kind of like one of these high-resolution weather prediction models within that climate model and kind of have it predict what the physical and chemical properties are going to be with the implications for the biology in our coastal waters out as much as 6 months and maybe 9 months if it looks practical. And the whole idea here is to see if, for example, conditions will be more or less favorable than usual for the survival of salmon.
Mm.
Another thing that is of great interest and importance to the ecosystem is oxygen concentrations. They have gotten dangerously low to low levels in some recent summers, leading to deaths of crabs and rockfish. And so we want to see, you know, is this going to be a bad summer for oxygen concentrations in the water, or, you know, relatively good one. And we're not sure how well we were going to do with these forecasts, but we know we don't know until we try.
Are the folks who do the offshore forecasting amenable to you adding this other search for data into what they're collecting?
Yeah, well, essentially, the people that are making the seasonal weather forecast or using this model are glad other people are,
oh,
you know, this other application, and just makes it that much more, you know, kind of meaningful to run that model. And I should add that this effort involves both University of Washington scientists and a group from NOAA's Northwest Fisheries Science Center. And so the marine biologists are definitely interested in what we can come up with and whether we can, you know, not just monitor the ocean, but actually give a heads up about what's liable to happen.
That's fascinating. Well, Nick, I'm sure that is going to be more interesting than our weather this weekend. So have fun at your talk, and thanks for talking with us today.
Yeah, thank you.
Nick Bond is the Washington State climatologist. He works at the Joint Institute for the Study of Atmosphere and Ocean. And the forecast for this weekend, gray, getting a little bit cooler tomorrow as a cold front moves in, but you can expect it to be warm, humid, and damp today, and maybe not the greatest day to go skiing. You can hear anything, any interview, any segment that you've heard on Weekday at our website, kuow.org. Just search for Weekday. Coming up in the next hour, our panel of journalists take on a lot of news. The sequester, President Obama was talking to the public again, as he has been doing for the last couple of weeks, campaigning for Congress to make a last minute agreement to avoid the sequester that is supposed to take effect tonight, which will trigger massive budget cuts and spending cuts across the board in all programs. We're going to be talking about that. We're also going to talk about yesterday's state Supreme Court ruling that the two-thirds supermajority for any kind of tax increase is unconstitutional. And we always invite you to join us in those conversations as well. Joni Balter, Knut Berger, Eli Sanders will be here as usual. I'm Marcy Silman, and this is 94.9 KUOW.
It's 9:59. News out this morning that consumer confidence is up. More in a minute. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Every Saturday night, the Swing Years and Beyond takes you on a tour of popular music from the 1920s through the 1950s. I'm Amanda Wild. Join me for the Swing Years and Beyond Saturday nights starting at 7 o'clock on 94.9.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.